This is World Watch's program number 829, October the 26th, 1987. Before I begin, I want to say that the views expressed here are those of myself and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kazoo staff or board of directors, and of course that includes for people that call in on the talk show part of the program. We want to thank Coast Components at 684-1185, the Monterey Bay Area's distributor of electronic components. Thank you for the underwriting grant that helps bring you the following hour of World Watchers. And also the following hour of World Watchers is made possible in part by Lowdown, a leading manufacturer of microcomputer peripherals located in Scotts Valley. For more information, call 438-7400. I got a lot of telephone calls last week from people who enjoyed the poetry of Robinson Jeffers. So to begin the broadcast that I'm going to do this evening, which is a continuation of various scandals in Washington, one large pack of lies after the other, I decided quickly to just read you an appropriate poem that Robinson Jeffers wrote in 1945 called Tehran. Now, there's a whole new generation listening to World Watchers who may think this has to do with the Iran-Iraq conflict. This has to do with the meeting of four heads of the large governments before the final days of World War II. The people meeting were Winston Churchill, who was already making deals with British intelligence, William Stevenson, and our OSS, just by way of background, to incorporate Nazis into our society immediately after the war was over, including Nazi war criminals. Another person at that famous Tehran meeting was Franklin Roosevelt, who would die shortly, and then President Truman was ready to swing right into the formation of the CIA and the National Security Council that have been our undoing ever since. Also at that conference was Chiang Kai-shek, who immediately after the war turned the Chinese army against the Chinese civilians, just as France used Clarice Barbie, and we did in other countries, to go against the resistance movement. And Chiang Kai-shek was working with the Japanese war criminals as soon as the war was over to wipe out the people who resisted the Japanese entry into China, believe that or not. And then there was Joseph Stalin at this meeting. So the pilot for this conference at Tehran was L. Fletcher Prouty, who wrote a book, The Secret Team, and has been trying to expose government corruption for the last 10 or 15 years. And he drove Franklin, he took care of the plane, flew him to Tehran and back, working in the Air Force. The poem by Robinson Jeffers, just before the war was over, is called Tehran. And this is what he said. The persons wane and fade. They fade out of meaning. Personal greatness was never more than a trick of the light, a halo of illusion. But who are these little smiling attendants on a world's agony, meeting in Tehran to plot against whom and what future? The future is clear enough in the firelight of burning cities and the pain light of that long battle line. That monstrous ulcer reaching from the Arctic Ocean to the Black Sea, slowly rodent westward, there will be Russia and America, two powers alone in the world, two bulls in one pasture. And what is unlucky Germany between their foreheads? Observe also how rapidly civilization coarsens and decays. Its better qualities, foresight, humanness, disinterested respect for truth, die first. And it is the disinterest in the respect for truth that I'm going to talk about this evening. Now, the first truth or untruth that was in the news of major importance for me and my research, and also for another researcher named Bill Kasing, who wrote the book We Never Went to the Moon. There's an article in the Houston Post, October 14th, just a week ago, titled Former NASA Worker Recalls a Foul-Up on the Moonwalk Photo. The article says the famous photographs of the first moon landing, believed by many to show Neil Armstrong, the first man to set foot on the lunar surface, aren't photos of Armstrong at all. Years of detective work, and this has taken many years, have confirmed what the chiefs of NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center, to their horror, suspected on the night of July 24, 1969, when thousands of reporters demanded a photograph of the first moonwalk. Everybody wanted one picture. They wanted the first man on the moon. They wanted the best picture of them. So it had to be Armstrong who put his foot down there, the first person on the moon. And Mr. Duff recalled how he found out that it wasn't Armstrong's picture at all. The three crewmen of Apollo 11 were then locked at that time into quarantine. This is for about 3 weeks after the return from the moon in 1969. NASA finally decided that they had to disturb them. I was the guy who had to call Armstrong, Duff said, that night and wake him up. I certainly felt uneasy and apologetic at that stage bothering anybody, but we simply couldn't find any picture identifiable of Armstrong. I'm reading this with great interest, and for those of you who don't understand why, I've had Bill Kasing on my radio program before. He wrote the book, We Never Went to the Moon, America's $30 billion swindle, and all of these lies I have to share this evening with you that are in the news this week have to do with some reasons why our economy is going hell backwards, with a lot of unexplained reasons and debts for nothing that we've invested. This was called the $30 billion swindle. Back to the Houston Post, this gentleman said, I remember the conversation and will for the rest of my life, Duff said. I said, Neil, we need a picture. When did you hand the camera to Buzz Aldrin? He said, I never did. There is no picture of the first man on the moon. The only photographic evidence that Armstrong ever stepped onto the moon comes from a 16 millimeter movie camera bolted to the lunar module hatch, and that camera only produced familiar fuzzy image of Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. Richard Underwood, NASA's photographic expert in Houston from the early 60s until 1985, said he searched and questioned the astronauts for several years, could never find a historic picture of Armstrong with his moonwalk. Whenever you try to bring it up with either one of them, they just won't comment on it. The one camera was hooked on Armstrong's suit. You have to get it off. You'd have to give it to the other guy. You'd have to have a conversation, and that famous picture was supposed to be Armstrong, Neil Armstrong, on the moon. The mistake was brought about by two changes in later missions. They corrected that and got a picture of somebody, supposedly we'll have to believe, on the next mission up there. But no conversation was ever recorded. They never said anything about switching cameras. There never was a question about the camera. Moonwalking astronauts had individual cameras to make sure they photographed each other. It was so difficult identifying Aldrin in photographs. Underwood said NASA officials discussed releasing Aldrin's picture and calling him Neil Armstrong, but they decided that the space buffs would spot the deception, and also the commanders wore red stripes on their suits starting up on the Apollo 13 flight. Now, I called Bill Kasing last night. He lives in Soquel, California, part of the time, and he said Seattle the rest of the time. He said Armstrong has been a recluse. He's written a book about the way the astronauts have hidden, refused interviews, gone crazy, mentally sick, or isolated for years. He said he will not talk about the Apollo at all. They've tried to talk to him about it. He wouldn't talk to Bill Kasing, and he will never discuss the Apollo. He says that's a while back. Well, I talked about We Never Went to the Moon. This was in 1984. It was September 3rd, 1984, World Watchers number 665. And in the introduction to Bill Kasing's book, this is the way it begins. Quote, apparently a substantial number of Americans do not believe their government landed on the moon, said David Weiss in The Politics of Lying. This is a well-known book that came out in 1973. On June 14, 1970, the Knight newspaper published an astonishing story based on interviews with over 1,000 persons. 1,721 people interviewed didn't really believe the U.S. astronauts had been to the moon. The government has been silent about this. There's been enormous secrecy and a harvest of massive public distrust. Now, how this book came to be written, Bill Kasing puts in his introduction. I'm not going to share much of it with you tonight, just a few points to illustrate one of many, many, many lies and big expenses this government had. He said, during the summer of 1969, I was living in Santa Barbara. I had worked 7 years at Rocketdyne, the firm that built the main propulsion units for Apollo. I could not work up the least bit of interest in the entire astrophysical circus. I decided I did not believe that Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin, or anyone else, was going to the moon, and consequently I could not generate any enthusiasm for watching a phony performance. Since the summer of 69, the feeling and belief that man's journey to the moon is still in his future became stronger. And as the years passed, I find myself comparing the Apollo flights to other incidents in American life, like Watergate was an outstanding example and a striking point of comparison of government lies. And the energy crisis was another lie, like the Apollo simulation. And then the book goes into details. Why did the Dutch newspapers in 1969 question the authenticity of the moon landing? Why is that NASA's Apollo records are not classified, but they're also not available to the general public? The answer to requests on this is, quotes, Apollo material not classified but unavailable. Why did so many astronauts end up executives of large corporations? Why did some of the astronauts die in accidents, others suffer brain damage, others have had nervous breakdown? Was this rate of attrition higher than should be expected with carefully selected and trained individuals? And he goes into other questions and then into the scientific parts about the Apollo simulation and described it as a military project, that the real purpose was to turn NASA into the Defense Department. And in 1965, the Air Force was going to use a modified Gemini spacecraft and turn it into an orbiting laboratory. NASA passed itself off as peaceful, but the entire operation was a Department of Defense payload. And he goes into the military aspects and that this was a military operation passed off as a civilian operation. I got out my book, We Reached the Moon, after seeing this article about not being able to have a single picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon. This was the official story of the moon landing, written by John Noble Wilford of New York Times, and the New York Times published this book, the same publishing company that did the Warren Report, that was another huge, massive lie a few years in 1963, that was, and this is goes on to 69. And in the entire book, there's not a single picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon. It begins on the mention of him on the moon is on chapter 20, on the moon at 10:56 on July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped into history from the bottom rung of the ladder leading down from Apollo 11's spacecraft. He reached out his booted left foot and planted the first human footprint on the moon. Then he uttered the long-awaited words that we are sure to be immortalized. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And, of course, we're leaping from there to the Star Wars, which will be the first strike, the goal of the Third Reich, to control the air and space and thereby controlling the world. Another big lie has to do with, why are we in Iran? What are we doing there? The question was asked by the foreign correspondent whose column is carried in the San Francisco Chronicle and also the Houston Post, William Pfaff, and I quote him many times, P-F-A-F-F. Today's article was, are we going to war with Iran? And he brings up the point that every day we get closer to the war, that the President of the United States and the NSC and the Defense Department made early claims that the U.S. Navy entered the Gulf merely to protect neutral shipping, and that they are following the actions which would make it safe for the waters to be used for shipping without attacks. And he wrote, it is perfectly plain that we are there serving Iraq's war interests, while Iraq can remain at liberty to attack the shipping that bears Iran's oil exports and arms imports. And remember, Iraq hit our ship, the Stark, and that was the reason for going into the war against Iran at that point, using Iraq to hit us. And then we say, oh, now we've got to get Iran. And William Pfaff makes the point that war is now the direction in which the United States now moves, not toward a big Iran-American war, which might settle things, a bloody war, but at a cost the Americans are, he says, Americans declined to pay, or would decline a big war, but keeping a little mini war. And he's saying there are two questions you have to ask. What is the cause of this war, and is this war worth a war, a larger war? And the second, will it settle anything as far as these issues go? But the lie was, in Europe, where he's writing from Paris, it's perfectly obvious that to keep the waterways safe for shipping oil back and forth is not the reason at all, but we're heading towards a war. Now, the Los Angeles Herald had a story this last week, October 20th. Pentagon keeps pool reporters sitting in the hotel. This is the press pool. And the important thing is that a war can start, and we will not have any press people to observe how it got started. I've mentioned this many times before, and it was Admiral Poindexter and Michael Ledeen and Robert Brown from Soldier of Fortune and the team that managed the Grenada invasion that began keeping the press away and said, we will select the press people to observe, we'll handpick them in advance, and so they can be on the site. And now the people that would be watching the Gulf are sitting at a hotel by a pool, swimming pool, where they are the press pool that should be in the Persian Gulf to see if we start our own war, as I've said, identical to what Adolf Hitler did with Agents Provocateurs when he went into Poland and created his excuse. This article says, while the U.S. Navy destroyers shelled two Iranian oil platforms yesterday in the Persian Gulf, members of a Pentagon-organized news pool sat in a hotel with nothing to do. It was a familiar experience for five journalists who were assembled September the 30th, almost a month ago. In that period since, the pool has been permitted only one visit to a Navy ship, a two-day trip that was scheduled for 6 days. The journalists were denied access to the scene or information after American helicopter sank an Iranian speedboat. Days later, the Navy provided four poor quality photos of two captured speedboats, certain background features that had already been doctored by the United States Army. Some pool journalists say they believe the Pentagon wants coverage only when it appears to suit their official purposes. After the 1983 Grenada invasion, where American journalists were officially barred from covering this this invasion, and the motives were covered up also for us going in there, a commission called the Seidel Commission was set up whereby the military would choose people to cover military events. The Pentagon set their own rules, and now they're not even sending people to the Persian Gulf to see what is going on. Pool members say they are not sure where in the military system the obstacles to their coverage lie. Where in the military system, obviously with the liars who want World War III, that's where it happens. But they are complaining that thousands of dollars are spent for them to sit at hotels in Miami and in Florida and not to be able to see what is going on in the Persian Gulf. There are some over there in Bahrain and Manama also, but they're not able to see the action and never given the go-ahead. Now, that kind of secrecy came out earlier and was reaffirmed October 14th in the Wall Street Journal. An article titled, Military Commanders Were Excluded from the Initiative in Iran. That was the arms that were sent to Iran by the National Security Council and Oliver North and Admiral Poindexter, and the many, many weapons that were sent to Iran, which I'm sure they were coaxed or persuaded to use or believed they were safe to use, and then that is our excuse to come back and call them the international terrorists, and the purpose was to force them to release hostages so Reagan would be reelected, not he, but his members of the House and the Senate in 1986, and that would have made a difference. Judge Bork would be in if all of those wishes of Reagan's had happened at that time, but the hostages weren't released, and the Defense Department was not included into these actions, just as the military are not included. Now, a very interesting and controversial subject came up about Edwin Meese and that company, that WedTech Corporation, that gets you into what is happening in the Gulf, and with Mr. Pfaff's article in Paris, coming from Paris today about war in the Persian Gulf. October 16, 1987, the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and the San Francisco Examiner had articles on the subject of Edwin Meese and WedTech Corporation. And the probe of WedTech is enlarging now to cover Meese's influence in the Persian Gulf. And some highlights of the articles are, I'll start with one of the articles and go through several of them. Investigators are looking into the activities of Attorney General Meese in connection with a San Francisco of Friends effort to secure government backing for a pipeline in Iraq, an oil pipeline in Iraq. The sources say investigators for independent counsel James McKay have been questioning several people recently about the involvement of E. Robert Wallach, W-L-L-A-C-H, Edwin Meese's personal attorney, a friend of Meese, and part of the Iraqi pipeline project. Investigators are trying to determine whether Meese introduced Wallach to U.S. officials involved in the project in 1985, while the White House was arming Iran. Edwin Meese and his friends, Lynn Nofziger, one of Reagan's closest friends, Meese, one of his very closest, were sending and arranging a $1 billion pipeline for Iraqi oil, while the other side of the story, you always hear that's the other side of the story, was sending the arms to Iran. This article tells about the expanded investigation will be focusing on Mr. Wallach's improperly influenced abilities of government over officials for the Iraq pipeline because of his contacts with Edwin Meese. One matter reportedly under investigation is whether Wallach invoked Meese's name in October 1985 and pressed Alan Gerson, a deputy assistant attorney general in the department's Office of Legal Counsel, for favorable ruling on the pipeline project. The ruling was crucial to the fate of the project that dealt with whether congressionally approved aid for Israel could be used as financing an Iraq pipeline. Edwin Meese taking money that is aid for Israel and putting it into a pipeline in Iraq, and Israel had been mortal enemies for a long, long time against Iraq. This is identical to the Camp David Accord when the members of EATSCO, that corporation with Edwin Wilson and Eric von Marbart and Thomas Kleins and Theodore Shackley, and that wonderful gang made millions of dollars off of, instead of sending arms to Egypt, they were sending them PLO. And the article goes on to say some witnesses have told McKay, the special prosecutor, that they were unaware that Mr. Wallach, Meese's attorney, had this stake in the pipeline at a time when he was pressing the case for the project and presenting himself for Meese or for the National Security Council. They are now investigating Meese's dealings with the WEDTEC Corporation that violated federal conflict of interest laws. Wallach, who was hired by Bronx, New York's company, and he's also Edwin Meese's attorney, asked Meese to review the company's bid for a defense contract, and Meese directed his staff to review this proposal. It was a no-bid contract for WEDTEC, and it involved Lynn Nofziger, a former White House political aide of Ronald Reagan. Also, he was very close with Richard Nixon administration, and he's a business partner of Helene Von Damm. The L.A. Times goes on with this horrendous story. At the press club in L.A., these issues were brought up, that the investigation of Meese has widened into the ill-fated Mideast oil pipeline project. And to make it even more horrendous, not only using Ronald Reagan's name and the Reagan administration in 1985 to promote the U.S. construction of a proposed pipeline to carry Iraqi oil to a Jordanian port, which came close to the border of Israel, but has nothing to do with Israel, but Israeli funds were going to be used. McKay is investigating Meese's role, and the contract was to go through, by way of Mr. Wallach, Meese's attorney, to a representative, a Swiss businessman named Bruce Rappaport, who was in partnership with Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco, the giant engineering firm, in hopes of building the $1 billion pipeline. Think of that. The head of Bechtel Corporation, the two heads of them, one is Caspar Weinberger, who's pushing this war in the Middle East, pushing it for all he can squeeze out of it every single day. He now wants to reflag every ship around there with the American flag. He was an officer of Bechtel. George Shultz, Secretary of State, an officer. They were chairman, attorney for Bechtel Corporation. They, under the table, were sending arms to Iran to make Iran appear like the mad, the crazies, and also to get our hostages out. So if Reagan's cabinet, his congressmen were reelected and the Republicans were in, both Shultz and Weinberger would be assured no further investigations. There wouldn't have been an Iran-Contra hearing. There would be Judge Bork on the Supreme Court. But lo and behold, it's Bechtel Corporation with Shultz and Weinberger and Edwin Meese taking money by way of recommendations of the National Security Council. In this article, uses the name of Robert McFarlane, who was involved in this, to build a pipeline for Iraq, favoring Iraq all the time for their oil, protecting their oil. This article says Edwin Meese and his wife Ursula invested $55,000 in a trust fund with W. Franklin Chin, who's a director of WEDTEC Corporation, and they would be helping get the pipeline going. Meese withdrew his investment from Chin just June of 1987 after all the Iran-Contra came down and he was being investigated under that scandal, but he had it tucked in with his holdings was under this WEDTEC corporation. Wallach acknowledged lobbying Meese on behalf of WEDTEC, a small defense contractor that ultimately won a $32 million Army engine contract without competition. And the first story of the pipeline inquiry was covered just this past Friday, a week ago, in the New York Times, and you'll hear more about it. Another former Reagan administration official said that William P. Clark, that's Ronald Reagan's close buddy and McFarland's predecessor as national security advisor, was asked by Wallach, the attorney for Meese, who's on the board of directors of WEDTEC, in 1985 to lend his support to the pipeline. Clark was a national security advisor who turned down Maurice Bishop, didn't want to help him, and that gave us an excuse to invade Grenada. So Ronald Reagan's close friends are involved in this. Tom Flynn, a vice president of Bechtel, said the firm ultimately gave up the project after Wallach failed to obtain Israeli guarantees they would not attack the pipeline. It was money for Israeli aid that was going to making an oil pipeline for Iraq, and Israel wouldn't guarantee that they wouldn't blow up the pipeline, and would you blame them? And so they stopped it because Israel wouldn't say that they wouldn't blow it up. By July 1986, Iraq was building two other shorter pipelines that would make the larger project less valuable. In October 1985, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, remember that name because next week I'm going to do a little bit more on that. It insures investments abroad by American corporations. They asked the Justice Department to determine if Israel could legally use congressionally approved foreign aid funds toward such a financial guarantee. They asked the Justice Department to determine if Israel could legally use these funds, but the funds were supposed to go from Israel through the Iraq pipeline the other way around. So our whole Iran-Iraq confrontation, which is now costing $1 million every single day, is part of our lies. Another major lie in this whole story, there's several parts of this, is the Star Wars story with Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, who quickly surprised the entire Defense Department and wrote a speech for Ronald Reagan, March 23, 1983, introducing the Star Wars that was another billions and billions like the moon, the Apollo program, and it would make us safe from every kind of a weapon. It would catch them as they all come to us and bounce it back. And he also helped write a 1986 speech for Ronald Reagan on the new laser that was part of the Star Wars program. So many of you probably saw the articles this week. I'm going to cite one from the San Francisco Examiner, Wednesday, October 21st. U.S. misled on the Star Wars, the ex-programmer said. Edward Teller, known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, was too optimistic, and he misled national leaders about the chances of developing the Star Wars X-ray laser weapon. Roy Woodruff, who resigned in 1985, was an associate director for defense systems at Lawrence Livermore Lab. He registered his grievance, and he said there was improper conduct by Robert Batzel, B-A-T-Z-E-L, director of the Nuclear Weapons Lab. He alleged that Batzel had failed to correct overly optimistic, technically incorrect statements by Edward Teller that would allow for a weapon system that probably wouldn't be safe, that would cost millions, maybe into several billions of dollars, and they knew at the time that it wasn't safe. What happened to Mr. Woodruff was that he was fired and dismissed and then taken back on the job. He wrote to the president of the University of California, that university is in charge of Lawrence Livermore Lab, and objected and said that his grievance came about from December 1983 through October 85, when Edward Teller and Wood engaged in numerous actions and undercut his management responsibility, and again, were overly optimistic, technically incorrect, and about the research, and the nation's policymakers were listening to Edward Teller when he was telling us untruths about the safety of Star Wars. I'll take a one-minute break now, and then we'll get back on to some of these lies, including the Star Wars lies, the moon lie, the Gulf, the Persian Gulf lie. Why are we in the Persian Gulf? And these things are what are really hurting our economy. We're talking about billions of billions wasted. I will do maybe 1 hour. I would like to do 1 hour on the economy and not cut it up in pieces. A lot of you would like to talk about it, and we can on the talk show part of the program. But in the meantime, I'll continue with this part of World Watchers, and we can cover that later if you want to call in and talk about it a little bit.